up against injustice and standing up in support of Palestine.
Dr. Baghouti, I wanted to get your response in this final minute to Israel's far-right minister, Bezalel Smotrich, calling the Gaza Strip a real estate bonanza, saying a business plan is on President Trump's table. He's added, we've done the demolition phase, now we need to build. And of course, this reinforces what President Trump has said on... He says the U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip and we'll do a job with it, too. We'll own it. We have 30 seconds on what especially responsibility the U.S. has.
What you say is a reflection of things that can only be said by fascists and by fascism. What the United States must do is to stop this terrible, horrible fascist tendency. Listen to the American people. The American people are changing, and they would not let this administration continue what they are doing.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian physician, activist, politician, serves as General Secretary of the Palestinian National National Initiative, speaking to us from occupied Ramallah. A very happy birthday to Jackie Sam. I am Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, Jimmy Kimmel returns to late-night TV.
The FDA recalls shrimp for possible radioactivity.
And many Oregonians can't cover a $400 emergency bill.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 22nd, 2025. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Late night TV host Jimmy Kimmel will be back on the air tomorrow night after the network ABC suspended his show indefinitely over his remarks about the deaths of far-right podcaster Charlie Kirk. FCC Chair Brendan Carr threatened regulatory action, saying, quote, "We can do this the easy way, or we can do this the hard way." He later claimed ABC pulling Kimmel was merely a business decision. On September 10th, Kimmel said, quote, "We hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it," end quote. The two companies who own many of ABC TV station's affiliates, Nexstar and Sinclair, pulled Jimmy Kimmel from live lineups. The move from ABC, Nexstar, and Sinclair were widely condemned by Hollywood stars and Hollywood unions. Local affiliates have the decision of whether to pull, rather to put Kimmel back on their schedule. KATU, the local ABC affiliate in Portland, has his show on the schedule for Tuesday at 11:35 p.m.
Shrimp enthusiasts beware. The Food and Drug Administration is recalling over 85,000 bags of shrimp. Why? possible radioactive contamination. The FDA issued a recall notice on Sunday. The recall affects three types of shrimp sold at Kroger stores in 31 states, including Oregon and Washington. Kroger stores include Fred Meyer's. The shrimp may be contaminated with cesium-137. Cesium-137 is a radioactive isotope of the cesium element. The EPA says it's used in medical radiation therapy devices for treating cancer. It's also a byproduct of nuclear fission in nuclear reactors and weapons testing. The isotope can cause burns and radiation sickness. Prolonged exposure can increase your risk for cancer. Specific raw and cooked shrimp products from Aquastar and Kroger brands could be impacted. The FDA recall affects bags sold between June 12th and September 17th of this year. Last month, the FDA recalled shrimp sold at Walmart for the same contamination. The recalls occurred after a shipping container from BMS Foods of Indonesia tested positive for CS-137. So far, none of the shrimp entering the U.S. have tested positive for the radioactive material. Still, the FDA says that you should dispose of the shrimp or return them to the store for a full refund.
One in three Oregonians say that they would have trouble covering an emergency cost of $400. That's according to a new poll from Oregon Consumer Justice and the Oregon Values and Belief Center. A third of those polled say they'd have to sell something or borrow money from a friend or family to cover an emergency expense. Those figures are consistent for Oregonians who live in rural and urban areas. Everyone's feeling the stress. There were differences in some other demographics areas. Most adults over 75 say they could cover the $400. Less than a quarter of adults under 30 agreed. A majority of college graduates say they could come up with the money in a pinch. Only 18% of adults who didn't graduate from high school agreed. 44% of white Oregonians say they could pay for an emergency. Only 28% of non-white Oregonians felt the same way. The poll indicates that people are feeling more financially insecure, with the most stress coming from housing and utility costs. The poll also asked what could be done. Researchers found that Oregonians want insurance companies to be held accountable for unfair rate hikes. Other economic indicators show it's been a tough economy in Oregon recently. Layoff rates have climbed in the past 2 years, and the latest unemployment numbers reached 5%.
Nurses at Providence Portland Medical Center say they're understaffed. The law mandates a specific nurse-to-patient ratio, but advocates with the Oregon Nurses Association say Providence isn't playing by the rules. NW Labor Press reports that fines for violating those laws can add up to $5,000 a day. Richard Botterill is an ER nurse and chair of the Oregon Nurses Association's bargaining unit. He told NW Labor Press, quote, "They are fighting tooth and nail to prevent what I think is an appropriate level of staffing in each of the different units we serve around the hospital." He said that one day, the nursing team had 27 different patients and one certified nursing assistant, CNA, for the entire floor. Botterill says the law calls for seven patients per CNA in that specific unit. The numbers come from House Bill 2697, which passed in 2023. The bill gave Oregon hospitals 2 years to comply with nurse-to-patient ratios. The Oregon Health Authority could issue fines as of June 1st of this year. Since June, NW Labor Press reports that there have been more than 2,200 complaints about staffing shortages from nurses represented by the Oregon Nurses Association.
Washington State has a relatively low rate of uninsured people. That may change soon. Cuts to Medicaid and surging prices in Washington's healthcare marketplace may change numbers for the worse. Experts estimate about 450,000 residents may lose healthcare as a result of the changes. Isabel Charlet has more.
About 450,000 Washingtonians may lose health care as a result of recent federal cuts and skyrocketing costs, according to new data. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act is projected to strip Apple Health from at least 300,000 people in the state. Another 150,000 are poised to lose federal supports that help them afford coverage on the state's marketplace. Sam Hatzenbieler of the Economic Opportunity Institute says that despite Washington's role as a leader in health care affordability, it now faces a hostile federal environment that threatens these gains.
We've done a great job successfully lowering our uninsurance rate, but the recent federal actions totally sabotaged that. And we may see uninsurance rates go back up to the levels they were at before the Affordable Care Act.
State regulators announced health insurance premiums on Washington's marketplace will jump by an average of 21% in 2026. Hatzenbieler says Congress could lessen the blow by renewing enhanced premium tax credits, which help consumers afford their marketplace coverage. Ed Travaglia of Vancouver says his family of four pays $25,000 per year for health insurance through Washington's marketplace, not including deductibles. He says the increase in costs is going to mean paying more out of pocket for less.
You almost consider, hey, we're reasonably healthy. Do we just try and pay this? Do we go without health insurance, which I've always considered to be a complete mad proposition?
Hatzenbieler says while state lawmakers will not be able to make up for all the cuts coming from D.C., they do have the power to protect against the worst of the cuts and prioritize the most vulnerable. Data shows children, seniors, and people with disabilities will be most impacted by the cuts.
We really need to make sure that we're using every tool in our toolbox to protect access to affordable health care. The well-being of our communities and our economy rely on us having a robust healthcare system.
According to Hatzenbieler, state lawmakers should focus on regulating the corporations that are making the most money off the state's healthcare system. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Today in 2025 Talks, conservatives are split over Kimmel's cancellation as Pentagon cracks down on journalists. New California law bans masks for ICE agents. And public library supporters are hopeful about future federal funds. With that story and more, it's Simone Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy and historic times.
They made a decision because Jimmy Kimmel said something that was extremely insensitive and a flat-out lie about the President of the United States, and there was no excuse for it.
Republican Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen says the chair of the FCC was justified in threatening ABC to force it to pull late-night comedian Jimmy Kimmel off the air. Democrats and some Republicans, including Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Kentucky's Rand Paul, say using government power to silence critics is a textbook violation of First Amendment free speech protections. President Donald Trump is demanding that Attorney General Pam Bondi use unrelated criminal charges to go after his political rivals. On social media, Trump lambasted Bondi for not finding charges to file against California Senator Adam Schiff, New York Attorney General Letitia James, or former FBI Director James Comey. The president also just fired a U.S. attorney for failing to charge James with mortgage fraud. Critics say using the justice system to attack opponents in that way is an impeachable offense. The Pentagon now requires reporters to pledge to report only approved information. The White House says Trump does not agree with the new restrictions. California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is signing a first-of-its-kind law banning federal and local law enforcement from wearing masks on duty.
If you're going to go out and you're going to do enforcement, provide an ID. Tell us which agency you represent. Provide us basic information that all local law enforcement is required to provide. Have the decency not to threaten people as they go to school.
Lawmakers in New York, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania have introduced similar legislation. Homeland Security says an ICE National Guard surge caught 5,000 undocumented immigrants in L.A. this summer, in spite of protests. Public library advocates hope a new bill in Congress will counteract a spring Trump executive order defunding the federal agency that supports them. The White House described the $300 million taken from the Institute for Museum and Library Services as shrinking a bloated federal bureaucracy. But Joshua Stone with the Maryland Library Association says libraries have historically been a nonpartisan issue.
That kind of goodwill has been chipped away at over the last few years through various groups that have lobbied various allegations toward libraries and thus kind of tainted the good name of libraries for some people.
Voters in Colorado will have the chance to provide universal free lunch to all students, paid for by a new tax on some of the wealthiest households. Voters approved the policy in another ballot measure in 2022, but it lacked a funding source. Jeriel Dyer says when they were struggling, her daughter skipped school lunches in embarrassment.
We're saying that if you are a student in Colorado, you get access to free meals so that you can commit to these other things in school rather than wondering when your next meal might be.
Canada, the UK, and Australia all recognize the Palestinian state ahead of a UN General Assembly. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney slammed Israel for its destruction of Gaza and expansion into the West Bank, while also calling on Hamas to release Israeli hostages. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News on Monday, September 22nd. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth report on the documentary Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of the Deceptive Climate Solutions with KBOO's own Barbara Bernstein. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather features a low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow, look for sunshine with a high of about 87, low of 56. Today in history, in 1789, the formal office of the United States Postmaster General was established. Previously, Benjamin Franklin served as Postmaster General. The Continental Congress appointed him in 1775. His actual annual salary was $1,000. The quote of the day is from John Oliver. From his monologue last night on September 21st, he said, quote, "Giving the bully your lunch money doesn't make him go away. It just makes him come back hungrier each time."
For those arrested by ICE, federal court has been one of the few places to find reprieve. That's where the lawyers of the Oregon Woodland firefighter who was arrested on the job last month are taking his case. KBOO's Sam Bowman has more on this story.
Lawyers are headed to federal court to demand the release of the Oregon wildland firefighter arrested by ICE while fighting a fire in Washington last month. Rigoberto Hernandez Hernandez is 23 years old, and he grew up in the U.S., the child of migrant farm workers. This was his third year as a wildland firefighter, and he was working at the Bear Gulch fire site on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State when he was arrested. Rodrigo Fernandez Ortega is a staff attorney at Innovation Law Lab.
On August 27th, armed Border Patrol agents working with National Park Rangers illegally arrested Mr. Hernandez at his job site in the middle of an active wildfire. The federal agents appeared at the extremely remote location in the blockaded fire emergency zone managed by the federal government, where firefighter crews were assigned to work to conduct an immigration inspection. This violated long-standing Department of Homeland Security policy that prohibits immigration enforcement at disaster response sites. Mr. Hernandez invoked his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, and the federal agents arrested him despite having no warrant or reasonable suspicion on account of his race and in retaliation for exercising his constitutional right to remain silent. The federal agents then hid him from his family and his lawyers for more than 48 hours.
Hernandez was waiting for the government to process an application for a U visa since 2018. He and his family were victims of a felony, and his father's testimony helped to get a conviction in the case. Fernandez Ortega says that's what U visas were designed for.
U visas are a tool to provide protected status to some victims of crimes, intended to encourage cooperation with law enforcement, to help communities solve crime, and protect witnesses from retaliatory immigration enforcement.
He says a long backlog in the broken immigration system means Hernandez's application hasn't been processed. Innovation Law Lab has filed a petition for habeas corpus and a motion for a temporary restraining order to release Hernandez. He's being held at the Tacoma ICE facility, where conditions are overcrowded and prison-like. Jordan Cunnings is the legal director at Innovation Law Lab.
So we're filing a petition for habeas corpus. This is a long-standing form of protection from unlawful detention. And so that petition asks that the court find his detention as unlawful and release him. The temporary restraining order communicates to the court the urgency of the matter. So we believe this petition should be heard promptly and his release should occur as soon as possible. Unfortunately, the immigration system is so broken right now that habeas corpus and the federal courts are the only remedy for people subject to unlawful detention. This administration recently has manipulated their administrative agencies to require mandatory detention for functionally anyone who is a non-citizen in this country and who they detain, no matter how they're detained. So habeas corpus relief has become the way that we're able to assert people's rights, remind people that this country is one of laws and of due process for all of us. And so, yes, we've had success, mainly because the administration's actions have been so egregiously unlawful and the immigration system is so broken that it allows continued detention without intervention from a federal court.
Cunnings says, federal court is one of the last remaining places where people have been able to find due process. I'm Sam Bowman.
The U.S. Department of Education announces major investment in tribal colleges and universities. The announcement comes months after the White House proposed cuts that could have caused some schools to close. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Last week, the U.S. Department of Education announced a nearly $500 million investment that'll in part help to fund TCUs, or tribal colleges and universities. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, it comes months after the White House proposed cuts that would have caused some schools to close.
Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin met with Education Secretary Linda McMahon for the first time in D.C. to explain why tribal education isn't DEI and how these institutions are tied to preserving language and culture.
And I had to remind her about the Navajo Code Talkers and the things that we've done for this country, and at the same time making sure that we fund our education properly, including our higher education as well. So she was very receptive.
But coming away from that recent conversation, Nigrin calls a big win. He admittedly did not expect what would follow just days later.
And then to get the good news after was even better, to know that over $100 million was going to be given to tribal colleges.
Like New Mexico's Navajo Technical University and the nation's oldest Diné College in Salie, Arizona, both chartered by the Navajo Nation. Three dozen or so TCUs initially faced a roughly 90% funding deficit. Now they'll get a one-time 109% increase. And Nigrin suggests it's a sign that the Trump administration is listening.
The meeting that I had with her the week before was honored by really upholding her treaty trust responsibilities.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
The first feature film ever made in Idaho was shot more than a century ago, and it included more than 100 members of the Nez Perce tribe. Although only a third of the film was recovered, it's been digitized and edited into a short film. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Lauren Patterson has more.
Told in the Hills is considered the first feature film shot in Idaho. It was filmed in Kamiai on the Nez Perce Indian Reservation.
It was made in 1919, and it was an unusual film, even for early cinematic standards, because of the unique and unprecedented collaboration with the Nez Perce tribe.
That's Colin Mannix, executive director of the Kenworthy Performing Arts Center. The silent film story follows Jack Stewart, played by Robert Warwick, a man from a wealthy family who tries to escape some family drama by heading west. But he gets himself into trouble. More than 100 members of the Nez Perce tribe were invited to participate in the filming.
They presented a lot of authentic cultural regalia as a part of the production.
The Nez Perce tribal members portray the Kootenai tribe in the film because the story takes place in rural Montana, despite being filmed in Idaho. After a young Kootenai chieftain is accidentally killed when he tries to bring a message of goodwill to the U.S. cavalry, Stewart is unjustly imprisoned, and the story follows how he escapes. Like many silent films, there will be music throughout the entire picture. The score for the new version of this long-lost Western romance was created by Diné composer Connor Chi.
What I ended up doing was writing, I think it's about 17 different pieces, 17 cues that had, you know, a variety of emotions that could match what I'd seen on the screen in this rough cut.
The music score will be performed live at the movie showing. Being a member of the Navajo Nation, Chi says he doesn't have to explicitly try to give his work an indigenous feel, because it's always woven into his work. But he says he did approach the music with a historical lens.
I wanted the melodrama to match sort of the time period in that sense of what you're seeing on screen.
The new version of the restored film will premiere at the Kenworthy Theater in downtown Moscow on the last Friday and Saturday of September as part of the theater's Silent Film Festival. Reporting in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lauren Patterson.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Mixed messages from the federal government about forever chemicals make environmental policy harder. Environmental advocates say that the nation faces added challenges in legislating against PFAS due to inconsistent federal messages about their use and danger. Studies suggest that this is the beginning of what could become a multi-generational environmental crisis. Edward J. Vieira has the story.
New York and the nation face added challenges in addressing forever chemicals. Studies show the next generation of pesticides contain PFAS, otherwise known as forever chemicals. The state has made an effort to ban products with PFAS in them due to research showing they're harmful carcinogens. Nathan Donnelly with the Center for Biological Diversity notes industrial groups support using the pesticides, but he says small farmers have concerns.
Although they want to be able to spray things to kill pests in their fields, they also don't want to contaminate the water their family's drinking. They're worried about some of these issues and wanting to see more safe pesticides approved.
But the approval of safe pesticides seems unlikely under the Trump administration. The Environmental Protection Agency has approved the use of 4 pesticides containing PFAS, though Donnelly notes states have the final say on allowing use of these pesticides. He notes some state-level departments of agriculture don't always have human health impacts in mind. He hopes states take a harder look at these chemicals to understand how they impact human health. There are mixed messages about PFAS coming from the Trump administration. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has spoken about tackling them as part of the Make America Healthy Again plan, but the EPA has been quick to amend or remove regulations concerning these chemicals. Donnelly says establishing a standard definition of PFAS would improve how these chemicals are regulated.
We're seeing vastly different definitions being used, and unfortunately in the regulatory context in the U.S., we're using a definition of PFAS that was outdated 15 years ago.
Using PFAS in rural areas could lead to water contamination, Donnelly adds. This comes at a time when New York State's Department of Health estimates 548 public water systems in the state exceed the maximum levels of PFAS allowed by the federal government. Donnelly says, given the nation's history with harmful pesticides like DDT, which is still impacting the environment, we should know better.
We've been here before. We know what happens when we release highly persistent pesticides into the environment. We saddle future generations with the burden of cleaning up those highly persistent chemicals and the health harms that come from that.
This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
Oregon has reached a demographic milestone this year. For the first time, the number of older adults surpasses the number of children. Elected officials and community leaders from across the state gathered this month for an age-friendly Oregon summit. The summit discusses what changes the state could make to better able to support people at all stages of life. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Community leaders across the state gathered to strategize about how to support the state's aging population at the Age-Friendly Oregon Summit. Organized by AARP Oregon, the theme of this year's summit was Catalyzing Age-Friendly Futures. The range of topics included transportation, financial wellness, and housing. AARP Oregon State Director Bandana Shrestha says there are more older people in the state than children for the first time ever, and that change will impact every sector.
It calls for really rethinking how we do business in our state. How do we plan? What kind of policies are necessary? What kind of programs are necessary to make sure that people of all ages can thrive?
Shrestha says the summit brought elected officials as well as advocates for the young and old together to share what is working best in their communities to make them more age-friendly. Jerry Conklin spoke at the summit about his work opening a senior center in South Morrow County in 2023. The center provides meals as well as many services and activities. Conklin says he's found programs are helpful, but emphasizes the most important thing older people need, especially in rural communities, is people.
Other people that they can identify with, other people that are going to encourage them, or sometimes even help them. So building community becomes a really important thing.
Many of the changes needed in Oregon will benefit people at any stage of life, not just seniors, Shrestha adds. For example, she says designing more accessible transportation will also benefit people with disabilities or with young children. children.
It's about the shared interests of different groups of people. And that's what an age-friendly and livable community allows us to do.
State economists forecast that by 2035, Oregon will have 40% more older adults than children. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Vancouver, Washington is looking for a new city flag, and a citywide contest has been narrowed down to 6 finalists. Each of the entries uses same colors, blue, green, and white, and many of them reflect similar values. They sought to represent the Columbia River and the surrounding nature, Fort Vancouver, and pay tribute to the Chinook, Klickitat, and Cowlitz tribes. 2 of the flags are merged designs that feature ideas from different entries. The flags were judged by a special committee based on the principles from the guide Good Flag, Bad Flag by Ted Kay. There are 5 main principles. Keep it simple, use meaningful symbolism, use 2 or 3 basic colors, no lettering or seals, and be distinctive or be related. Vancouver residents can give their feedback on the flags online throughout the city's website, cityofvancouver.us. On Saturday, October 4th at 10 a.m., all 6 finalist flags will be hoisted on the Vancouver City Hall flagpole to see how they look while flying. Vancouver is expected to make a final decision in November.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 22nd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Anna Wilcox, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Brian Bull, Zamone Perez, and Isabel Charlet. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO programming, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to